One of Public Radio's favorite historians joins us in just a bit today on Travel with Rick Steves. Sarah Vowell explains how there probably wouldn't have been a United States without the help of the French. We'll get to know why the Marquis de Lafayette became an American hero, as well as the namesake for many American towns, squares, and boulevards. And friends from Scotland raise a glass with us with tips for touring the Scotch whiskey tasting rooms across their country. That's a little later in the hour. As an editor at National Geographic, Mark Adams figured the centennial of Hiram Bingham's famous find at Machu Picchu deserved a special treatment. After all, it was his magazine that devoted a special issue in 1913 to what was considered one of the greatest archaeological finds of the 20th century. Mark thought it would make a great story to revisit the perilous jungle and mountain route Bingham took 100 years earlier. The only problem was, up until then, Mark had never even slept in a tent. Mark Adams wrote his book, Turn Right at Machu Picchu, about his adventure, and he joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves to tell us about it. Mark, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Set the scene. Who was Hiram Bingham, and what did he discover?
So Hiram Bingham is a history lecturer at Yale in the early part of the 20th century. You know, this is sort of the golden age of exploration. People are going off to the South Pole and doing things like that, finding rivers in Africa. You know, Bingham is very driven. He wants to make a name for himself, and he focuses on South America. He's in South America in 1909, and he hears the story of the lost city of the Incas, which was supposedly a mountaintop to which the Incas ran with all sorts of treasure when the Spanish conquistadors invaded with Pizarro in 1532. Supposedly, the trees grew over, and, you know, this great treasure was lost forever. So he hears this story and decides he's going to come back in 1911 and look for the lost city of the Incas, which he knew under the name of Vilcabamba. And he spends that summer looking for Vilcabamba, and he goes to three separate locations. And along the way, he hears a tip that there's an interesting set of ruins on a sort of mountain ridge along the Urubamba River outside of Cusco in Peru. And this innkeeper takes him up there and he says, well, what do you think? And he squints and he can't see it at first. And then he looks and boom, there's Machu Picchu. And he's maybe not the first non-Peruvian to see the ruins of Machu Picchu.
Wow. You know, we say Hiram Bingham discovered it, but it was well known by local people. He just discovered it.
Yeah, I mean, when he got up there, there were three families up there living, you know, growing peppers and tomatoes in the ruins of Machu Picchu.
Oh, man. It must have just blown him away. But you didn't just accidentally get there. He had to hike quite a ways to get there. Now,
Oh, yeah. It's 2,000 feet up from the river. So he put in a full day's work. The thing that he did, though, that was so smart was he brought his camera with him.
This
is the early days of National Geographic magazine. He goes to meet Gilbert Grosvenor at National Geographic, who's the great mind there. And Grosvenor immediately sees the potential of Machu Picchu, sends Bingham back in 1912. They give it a whole issue.
Wow.
You know, even with a foldout of the ruins.
Oh.
And that's what makes Machu Picchu famous.
And he was a professor at Yale, right? So he had credibility and...
He was a lecturer at Yale, yeah. The funny thing is they had denied him a full professorship. Hmm. So he was a little bit more driven because of that.
Describe your mission, because a lot of people know about Machu Picchu and everything, but
you
were more looking at Hiram Bingham's experience in actually roughing it and imagining what it would be like to get there 100 years ago. What was your agenda there?
Well, you know, I was working as an editor at National Geographic Adventure magazine, the late lamented travel magazine. It was weird because I would, you know, be passing judgment on things like camp stoves and sleeping bags and such, and I'd never actually slept in a tent. So I thought, you know, I'm 41 years old. If I'm ever going to go out and have any sort of adventure, now's the time to do it. You know, my wife is from Peru. I saw the 100th anniversary of Bingham was coming up, and I thought, you know, this is a chance to go down there and see how much of what Bingham saw is still the way it was and how much has changed. And the very surprising answer was not much has changed. Once you get outside of the, you know, immediate vicinity of Machu Picchu and all the tourism infrastructure that's there, you know, you've got guys who are digging rows to plant potatoes the same way they did in 1700.
Hmm.
And when I went down to the jungle to Espiritu Pampa, which is the site of the Vilcabamba, the lost city, the head archaeologist there told me, if guys with bowl cuts wearing dresses come out of the jungle, run.
No.
Because they live by their own rules and some of them have never seen a white man.
And that was probably advice given to Bingham also.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and that's within 50 miles of Machu Picchu.
You wrote, Bingham started out as a martini explorer and turned out to be a real adventurer. What's that and how so?
That was a term that my guide, John Liebers, came up with. You know, he was thinking of a guy he knew who, at the end of the day, liked to have a nice chilled glass of vodka. I said, you know, if you're going to be somewhere where you have ice to chill a glass of vodka, that's not a real adventure. And that's where we got into the discussion of what is the difference between a tourist and what is a traveler.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Mark Adams, and his book is Turn Right at Machu Picchu. Mark's website is markadamsbooks.com. Hey, Mark, when you're doing something like learning about Machu Picchu and trying to get an appreciation of it, I would think you do some general study to gain an appreciation of pre-Columbian civilizations in general as they relate to Europe before 1492. Because I always feel like we think that we're going into primitive zones when, in actuality, some of these civilizations were arguably as sophisticated as the civilizations that these European conquistadors were coming from.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, for a long time, historians said that because the Incas did not have the wheel and they did not have a written language, they were not a real civilization, even though they had conquered the largest empire ever known in the Western Hemisphere. In recent years, they've realized that they were just using a different system of record keeping. They had these things called quipus, which were sort of knotted colored cords made of different fibers. We don't know 100% how these things work because during the Spanish Inquisition, most of them were confiscated and burned. I think there are only 800 or so known in the entire world right now. The secret weapons of the Incas were A, engineering. You know, look at the ruins of Machu Picchu. There are earthquakes down there, and those buildings are made, as they say in Peru, to dance. You know, they don't fall down because they're constructed to dance, even though the stones are so close that you can't fit a credit card between two of them.
Wow.
The other secret weapon of the Incas was organization. They were the greatest accountants of the ancient world. When the Spaniards arrived in 1532, the Incas had storehouses filled with food and clothing to last for 20 years, and they had these quipus keeping records of everything that they had. And the Spaniards were just blown away. They're like, this is the most organized place we've ever seen in our entire lives.
Does Machu Picchu align with the sun like Stonehenge does?
You know, it's very interesting. There's an anthropologist named Johann Reinhardt who discovered that, you know, Machu Picchu is probably what we call a sacred landscape. Mm-hmm. You know, the mountains are positioned in certain places. The buildings are constructed along certain sun lines for the solstice. If you go there on June 21st and stand above what's called the Torreón, the most impressive building at Machu Picchu, it's like Indiana Jones. There's a beam of light that comes through a rectangular window and shines a perfect rectangle on this sort of base, this stone base that something has obviously been cracked off of. We don't know what it was. Hmm. It may have been a statue of the emperor who had Machu Picchu built. But it's just so incredible the way the sun shoots down certain corridors on certain important days of the year.
So it's not just hocus pocus or accidental. They understood designed this with that in mind. And even if we don't
absolutely
know why,
not.
It is really quite astounding.
They chose the site and then they designed it on top of that.
God, that is just mind-blowing. In the 10 years since they first published Mark Adams' book, Turn Right at Machu Picchu, Rediscovering the Lost City One Step at a Time, Mark reports that before the pandemic, the site was becoming crowded with Instagrammers and even an international airport was being proposed. But he still sees it as one of the most amazing places on Earth. His website is markadamsbooks.com. Now, we've got this legendary city of gold. Just how much gold and silver are we talking about? What happened to the gold? Describe the scene just in Incan archaeology in general. And was there gold at Machu Picchu? Was that a repository for all of this gold?
Here's what we don't know. No major cache of gold was ever found. Bingham found, I think, one single bracelet of gold, even though there are rumors in Peru that he took, you know, truckloads, trainloads of gold out. There was someone who was at Machu Picchu, a German named Augusto Burns, in the 1860s, and he had some sort of mining prospectus, which may have been sort of a cover to try to get stuff out of Machu Picchu. What they call a huaquero, a guy who, you know, steals grave sites. Whether he got anything out of there, we can't know. Whether there was originally any gold up there, we can't know. I mean, those hills, all of those sites in Peru and you know, pretty much everywhere around the world, you know, have just been picked clean by grave robbers over the centuries.
But Bingham was very good at bringing artifacts back, because that was quite a scandal with Yale. Bingham brought back like thousands of actual pre-Columbian artifacts from the England civilization.
He brought back a lot of artifacts. He brought back some pottery, and he brought back human remains. And I think that was a very touchy subject. The ironic thing is that Bingham may have brought back artifacts that he purchased from an estate owner near Machu Picchu that came from Machu Picchu, but we don't know because grave robbers may have gone up there, taken them, brought it down to this estate owner. And those are the most beautiful things he actually brought back from Peru because the site had been pretty much picked clean.
They probably just got dispersed all over Peru over the ages.
Absolutely.
By people picking up shiny stuff and selling it to rich people.
And those are things that Yale is actually allowed to hang on to because he bought them legally. But in 2011, for the 100th anniversary, they had to send back all the other stuff that Bingham took while, you know, on assignment from National Geographic.
You approached Machu Picchu, you made a point to approach it, as Hiram Bingham did, the hard way.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's the old saw about the journey is the experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why something like the Inca Trail, if you can get a spot, it's so hard to get a spot nowadays, can be so amazing because this whole area, the Inca Trail, Machu Picchu, was obviously laid out as some sort of pilgrimage. And if you can do it on foot rather than arriving by train, you know, arrive on train if you have to, but if you can give it 4 or 5 days and make the walk, mm-hmm. you know, it's just that much richer when you walk through that sun gate and you see Machu Picchu for the first time. I mean, the revelation of Machu Picchu, anyone who has been there knows, is just, it's like walking into a natural cathedral. It's just mind-blowing, and pictures and video cannot do it any sort of justice. You know, it's one of those rare things, like the Mona Lisa, that is better in person than you ever imagined it could be.
Mark Adams, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for writing Turn Right at Machu Picchu.
Thanks for having me.
We'll explore the whiskey trails of Scotland in just a bit. Up next, it's a real treatise. Author Sarah Val joins us to tell us how the Marquis de Lafayette became a universally beloved figure in a contentious United States. That was nearly 200 years ago when political divides between Americans rose to new heights. We're at 877-333-7425 on Travel with Rick Steves.